Welcome back to our final class for the intro to mindfulness meditation. And in the first 4 weeks of the course, I tried to provide you with the basic instructions for mindfulness meditation. And to give those instructions, to review those instructions very, very briefly, the idea in mindfulness is to pay attention to what is happening in the present moment. So first, it's a training to learn how to be in the present. And we often find the mind drifts off from the present, to the future, the past, and thoughts, and fantasy. So it's a training to be present. And then, but more than being present, it's a training to notice what is happening in the present moment. Anything and everything that happens in the present moment is the subject of mindfulness practice. So we say there's nothing outside. There's no outside to this practice. Some meditation practices focus primarily on the breath, and that's all you do. And so then there's an outside to that, in a sense. Then there's sounds outside, or feelings, or emotions, or thoughts, and they are sometimes called distractions. Or some people do a mantra meditation, or do a visualization meditation, or there's many kinds of meditations people might do. But in mindfulness meditation, the idea is all of life is the domain of practice. So that there's no outside. There are no distractions. And there's nothing outside. And I think one of the things that makes, I'll say it this way, one of the most sacred realities or aspects of Buddhist practice is awareness itself. So awareness becomes sacred, something about the awareness which is sacred. But it's awareness that has no outside. As soon as we distinguish and separate between what is acceptable for awareness and what is not acceptable, then we've kind of lost touch with that sacred dimension of awareness which is all-inclusive, that can hold everything within it. Sometimes in Buddhism it's called big mind. This big global awareness that can include everything within it, that doesn't put up defenses or resistances, or doesn't try to have blinders on, or various ways. And so mindfulness practice is the practice of paying attention to what's happening in the present moment, being able to pay attention to the full show, whatever is happening. When we do meditation practice, we do give some emphasis to the breath as a place to ground the attention, as an anchor for the attention in the present moment. And there's a lot of benefits to being with the breath. So as long as you can kind of be inspired and dedicated to stay with the breath, just stay with the breath best you can, until some other experience comes along and is more compelling than the breath. If something else is more compelling, say body sensations or feelings or sounds or thoughts, then the practice is to take that as a subject of meditation. It's included. So rather than resisting something which is coming up, we invite it in. So, okay, this too I have to include now and discover how to have this meditative mind, this meditative awareness of this also. So that's kind of what I tried to convey the first 4 weeks of this course. Today what I'd like to do is primarily two things. Two ways of developing developing this basic practice. One way is by coupling the mindfulness with concentration. So developing the ability to be present with a much stronger capacity to being concentrated in the present moment. And the second way of developing the practice is to extend it from meditation into our daily lives. So because the line between meditation and daily life is an arbitrary line that we make up. The mind that we have is the same mind. We were sitting in meditation or walking about the streets, it's the same mind. And so the care, the attention, the presence that we can give in meditation is something that we can do just as well in daily life. And sooner or later, people who do a lot of mindfulness meditation become very interested in extending the integrity of meditation, the presence of meditation, the clarity of meditation, the mindfulness into the rest of their life, because they see this tremendous amount of benefits maintaining that or practicing that also in daily life. So two primary ways of developing the practice once you get the basics down. One is to develop it with greater concentration, and the other is to begin extending it into daily life. So I'll talk about those two. But in order to talk about those two or develop those two aspects of it, it helps to have the sitting practice as a foundation. And the stronger the sitting practice is, the more regular practice you have, the more familiar you are with the whole world of meditation, the easier it will be to develop these other two aspects of it. So, having said that, we should meditate first. So, take a comfortable but alert posture, comfortable and alert posture. Meditate. So, a calm, conscious attention to your posture. So your posture is not casual or unexamined, but you actually calmly, consciously assume a good posture, upright, balanced. Perhaps letting your attention travel up your spine so your spine feels as balanced and alert as possible. Gently close your eyes. And it can be helpful to take a few long, slow, deep breaths, feeling your body, your chest as you breathe in, and as you exhale, relaxing. Letting go. Shoulders, belly, muscles of your face. Breathing in deeply. Relaxing as you exhale. Letting your breath return to normal. And with a normal, easy breath, maybe again scan through your body and see if there's any parts of your body that you can settle, relax. It's helpful to have a soft, relaxed belly. Soften a little bit around the shoulders. So then the anchor for the awareness is the breath. See if you can establish your attention, your awareness, on how the body experiences breathing in and breathing out. Notice your breathing. It's inevitable that the mind will wander off in thought. And when it does that, let go of your thinking the best you can. Tell your thinking, not now. And then begin again with your breathing. Relax with your breathing. Let the breathing relax you and center you, stabilize you. Keeping the awareness soft, ready to be aware of other things if they become compelling. Sounds, very simple recognition. You're hearing a sound. That's what's happening in the present. Or body sensations, or feelings, emotions, or thoughts, thinking. Clearly acknowledging, recognizing what is happening as it's happening, while the awareness of it all stays soft, relaxed. It's all okay. no matter what is happening for you, it is something that can be acknowledged and noticed within awareness. We'll sit just for another couple of minutes, and these last couple of minutes, just take refuge in awareness, in knowing what's happening as it's happening. And otherwise, let whatever's happening be okay. Accept everything within the field of awareness, an awareness that excludes nothing, big mind. Sometimes this mindfulness practice is described as an acceptance practice. There's even a book called Radical Acceptance. And I think it's helpful in talking about the language of acceptance to distinguish between two kinds of acceptance. One is some kind of naive or simplistic approval of whatever's happening. And the other is the kind of acceptance where whatever is going on is accepted within awareness. And the awareness does not contract or resist or do anything about what comes into awareness. With a mind that's, with an accepting awareness, our intelligence, our wisdom, our values, and all kinds of things can still come into play where we say, no. You know, you don't have to necessarily accept physically or in the world what many things going on. So sometimes when people hear the word acceptance, they think, oh, I'm supposed to accept everything now. And that's not what's meant. What's meant is that it's accepted within the field of awareness. And with that, that once it's accepted there, then we use our wisdom to know what to do. So we have the expression, I think, maybe similar to the expression in English of, you know, someone who's open-minded. You know, someone's open-minded with everyone. But being open-minded doesn't mean they still don't, you know, take a stand. But they're still open-minded. They, you know, they're, or open-handed, kind of just honest, fair in their dealings. And they're, you know, they're not going to be held back or tight. So there's some quality of awareness where the awareness can be some quality that can be open, present, still, calm, and remain that way, even in times of great challenge. And in that capacity to stay calm and open and aware, that they have that accepting awareness, makes it a lot easier to make wise decisions about what to do. And so probably many of you have heard the distinction between reaction and responding. So when we react, it's kind of the habitual, often habitual, the idea is it's kind of the habitual knee-jerk reactions. And response is when it's somehow conscious or clear or deliberate or deliberated, where we're kind of actually responding from some sense of wisdom or clear understanding what's needed in the situation, not from habit or automatic pilot. Now, the mindfulness practice is not only about developing some capacity for accepting awareness. Accepting awareness, or non-reactive awareness, is a stepping stone or a foundation for going further. Now, in meditation practice, further means to develop a much more penetrating capacity to see what is happening in the present moment. The idea being that most of the time, the way that we experience, perceive, recognize, construct our reality is relatively conceptually coarse. And it's possible to look more carefully at our experience and look behind the veils of the concepts we have and see more clearly what's actually happening in the moment. And so once we can stabilize ourselves in the present and be non-reactive, then we look more carefully. What's really going on here? And the classic question in Vipassana, with this kind of insight meditation question, insight meditation practice, is the question, what is this? What is this experience I'm having? Okay, let me look more closely. What's really happening here? And so the accepting awareness allows us to look more clearly. If the awareness is not accepting, then the awareness is somehow clouded over or veiled. You can't really see very clearly. You have to have the accepting awareness in order to see deeply what's going on. So I think it's very difficult for someone who hasn't done something like meditation to appreciate how thoroughgoing is our conceptual relationship to our world. That we, almost like human beings, paint our reality with concepts. And then we live in the painting rather than what's really happening in the experience. And sometimes the paintings we paint over reality is relatively accurate. We paint cars as cars, maybe. But sometimes it's wildly inaccurate. Sometimes it's very arbitrary. Things can be very different than how they first appear, or how they appear, or they can be changed. We call this a meditation hall, but it wasn't always a meditation hall. You know, it was a church once, you know. The meditation hall at San Francisco Zen Center in San Francisco used to, we call the meditation hall now, it used to be a dance hall. You know, and we could easily, you know, turn this room into something very different. You know, it had a wonderful stage up. We call it a stage. I don't think if it was a church they called it a stage. I don't know what they called it, but you know, we could make it in this thing into a little theater here. We could shut down IMC and open the Redwood City Community Theater, and it'd be very nice. And this becomes, you know, the theater hall. So, you know, so meditation hall is a concept. And then how do we relate to that concept? You know, as a teacher for IMC, I could have a very uptight relationship to the meditation hall. You know, please be very quiet, be very, you know, there's a certain decorum, a way of behaving, and I'm the guardian of the decorum, and I get really upset if anything goes off and wrong, and, you know, it could be that way, right? But if I came into a theater, I would have a very different relationship to it. So we can have a relationship to the concept that can cause suffering or cannot cause suffering. So we need to understand the nature of concepts. But more than that, in Vipassana meditation, we want to be able to look through them more deeply. And so to give you a little sense of how this can be done and how this opens to a kind of wisdom or a wise understanding of our reality, what's going on, I brought with me some flowers. There's a long tradition of holding up flowers in Buddhism. So I'm going to hold up flowers. So you have here a flower. Is that right? You see the flower? You see the flower as it actually is, right? We say in Buddhism, we talk about the thusness, the suchness of something. So you see the flower, you maybe see the suchness of it. Except some of you are thinking, what's he up to? And are trying to, you know, race ahead, probably because a flower is like a bud that opens up, and you know, and that's what we're doing here. We're opening up like our bud of our awareness, and that's what is, you know. So we already have all, you have ideas about what I'm trying to do, but if independent of your ideas, just looking at it, right, the suchness of a flower, as it is. Now something very interesting can happen. That and very new can happen. If I hold up this flower next to the first flower. See? You see it? So, now you can say something you couldn't say before. You can say, this is the big flower, and this is the small flower. This is the tall flower, this is the short flower. This is the alert flower, this is the wilty flower. You can say things about flowers. You can say it's the tall, short, big, small, right? So, but now I'm going to do a magic trick that involves no sleight of hand, right in front of your eyes. So you've noticed, right, the big, small, right? Now this one's a small one, and this is the big one. What happened? Bigness and smallness, short and tall, are comparative categories, concepts. that are not inherent in the object. It's not inherent in this object that is short or tall or big or small. It's something that only exists when you compare it to something else. But comparative thinking is conceptual then. It's concepts we live by. There's some accuracy to it, but it doesn't represent the suchness, the thusness of the thing in and of itself. So if the mind is constantly comparing and contrasting, it's very hard to see something as it actually is in and of itself. And some minds, some people, are just doing it all the time. They're judging, they're criticizing, they're comparing, they're evaluating. They've, you know, all the time. One of the great sources for suffering in human beings centers around their concept of self, the idea of who they are. And most of that suffering around self, it belongs to this category of comparative thinking. We're comparing ourselves to something. Other people, other standards, other something different. And all that comparison makes it very hard for us to see ourselves in our own suchness. So, you know, you might think, oh, I'm too tall, or I'm too short. You know, compared to what? If I tell you that I have a really bad self-concept, my self-esteem as a basketball player is just pitiful, then you should ask me, compared to who, right? Because it's a comparative statement, compared to who? And I say, well, compared to Michael Jordan. And I think probably you just shrug and say, you know, Gil's crazy, you know, to have low self-esteem because that's who you compare yourself to. You know, compared to the eighth grader, you know, the down the street, I'm hot stuff. But I choose to compare myself to, you know, one of the great masters of the sport and tie my self-esteem to that. So too much, too little. I suffered some in junior high school, I think, about my hairline. I thought my hairline was too high. And I spent a lot of time in class measuring my hairline with my finger, making sure that it wasn't kind of receding. And I can tell you that it's still the same. You know, that's, again, it belongs to the world of comparative thinking. And that's funny, those things. But some of the ways comparative thinking happens is tremendously sad. And what people do to each other, let alone what they do to themselves, in the world of comparative thinking, is just, you know, it's worse than tragic in this world of ours. So part of the opportunity in mindfulness practice is to begin quieting the mind enough, stilling the mind enough, so that when we look and see what is really here, what is this, we can differentiate between those comparisons, those concepts we overlay on the experience, overlay ourselves, overlay others. We can see that, maybe let that even stop and fall away, and then see something as it actually is, in what's called the suchness or the thusness of the experience. And for some people, that is a very frightening thing to do, because their way of orienting themselves to the world, finding security in the world, is by knowing who they are and knowing who they are in relationship, in comparison to other people and other things. And to not do that comparative thinking is very disorienting sometimes. But to let go of the comparative thinking and just let yourself be at rest in who you are or what's happening without any comparison is to taste some qualities of freedom, of liberation, to rest in the suchness of what's happening, the thusness of it. So part of the, so this ability to still the mind enough. So some of that has to do with seeing clearly. So seeing clearly, oh, this is concepts, this is comparison going on. And then kind of looking around and seeing what's really going on here. And some of it arises when, as we get calmer and calmer, more settled in meditation, the conceptual thinking part of the mind begins to quiet. And it doesn't mean necessarily you stop thinking all the time, but you're less and less inclined to conceptualize about your experience. And a lot of the way in which we relate to everything is by concepts. So that thinking part of the mind can come to rest. And then a tremendous clarity can arise about the suchness and thusness of what's happening. And the insight of insight meditation is not insight into your psychology, not insight into, you know, in third grade your teacher did X and therefore that's what you, now you do this because of that. And there's all kinds of psychological insights that people can have that are important. But the insight of insight meditation is the kind of insight we see when we're no longer seeing our experience through the conceptual lens. And we're not seeing something that's personal to ourselves, but we're seeing insight into something which is universal. Universal qualities or characteristics of life. So in order to do this, greater stilling, beyond the acceptance point of the practice, it's necessary to have a fair degree of concentration. Concentration is a very important partner for mindfulness practice. In deep meditation practice, there has to be both strong mindfulness and strong concentration. To some degree, concentration follows in the wake of mindfulness practice. If you just practice mindfulness meditation every day, with regularity, the mind will become more stabilized, more focused, and more concentrated with time. There has to be the regularity if you want concentration. Practicing every day, perhaps sitting more, more than once a day, perhaps going on retreat periodically, day-long retreats or weekend retreats or longer retreats. One of the great things we do in our tradition is go on meditation retreats. And IMC offers them here, day-longs and non-residential retreats. Spirit Rock offers them that are longer. We offer them here that are nearby, that are residential retreats. And in fact, our particular Buddhist tradition came to America 30 years ago as a retreat tradition. That's what we're really about. And then slowly, as we kind of got established here, we kind of spilled over and started establishing, you know, these kind of community meditation centers and focusing on the importance of practicing daily life. But we started off really as a retreat tradition. That's how important it is. And there are silent retreats. And some people find that very frightening or strange, but it just, most people I know, if they get to the end of the retreat, they love the silence. It's just the best. And though some people will feel like they're going to run out screaming the first couple of days, but it's really fantastic to have that ability to let go of the social self, the social concerns that come into play when we're talking. So much of this comparative thinking and suffering around self happens a lot in conversation. And if that part of a relationship kind of stops after some days, a wonderful new thing can happen. There's very little that goes on retreats except meditation. Because that's primarily what a person's doing, there can be this calming and settling that happens on the retreat that allows the concentration to build together with the mindfulness. So in our tradition, one of the ways of developing strong concentration together with mindfulness is to go on retreats. Another way, which I mentioned already, is the regularity of practice. So practice every day. The analogy we use is that if you're going to make fire by rubbing two sticks together, you rub for a little while, and you say, oh, you know, I need to go get some tea. And you put the sticks down, come back later and pick them up and rub some more and say, well, now I need to go pee. You go and come back, and then you rub for a while longer. Oh, this is tiring. I think I'll go call my friend. And I'll come back, and you know, If you keep doing that, you never build up enough friction, enough momentum to create a spark. You have to keep at it. It's like, so the regularity is kind of like that. So practicing every day is one way of bringing concentration together with the mindfulness. There's also, for some people who are inclined this way or for whom it's appropriate, it's helpful sometimes to not do mindfulness practice for a while, but only do a concentration practice. There are particular concentration practices, and one of them is concentrating on the breath. And spending some period of time, a few months perhaps, maybe a year, or some period of time, only staying on the breath as a concentration practice, putting aside any other, paying attention to anything else, just the breath. And so the mind becomes strong and concentrated. Some people like doing that. And then after that, they've built that muscle of concentration, then they can come back to the mindfulness and they have that muscle with them, it's right there. And so they can, there's more concentration with the mindfulness. So in somehow or other, coupling concentration with mindfulness is one way of taking the practice further. Not everyone is interested in this, going that route. It's not necessary. I mean, nothing's necessary here. But some of you might be interested or curious. What is it like to do that, to take the practice to that next level? The other direction to take the practice is the integration of the practice in daily life, or the application of it in daily life. So to practice the same mindfulness in daily life as you would on the cushion. So noticing what's happening as it's happening. What's happening right now? Being in the present in your daily lives. It can be as simple as making a decision. When I drive my car, I'm going to focus on being present. It's probably a good idea anyway. But really present. Not just kind of half present. Present enough to drive the car, but really present. And the mind will wander off, just like on the cushion, and you let go of it and come back to, here I am driving. This is what, my hands on the steering wheel, I'm looking out the window, you know, I'm driving. Come back. And just do this one thing, just drive. The mind wanders, come back to just driving and pay attention to what you're doing. That's one way. And some people who do that find that they arrive in their destinations so much more refreshed that way than that they are if they're listening to the radio or talking on the phone. Or other things, or complaining about the other drivers. Just do this one thing. Some people like to have little moments during the day where they're reminded to really pay attention to what's happening right now. It's a little, what's called mindfulness cues or mindfulness bells. And it's quite surprising sometimes if you have a regular cue. Like, for example, you could put the timer on your beeper on your watch on, right? Maybe every half an hour it can go off. Beep, beep. And that's a reminder, pay attention to what's happening now. And I would venture to guess that for most of you, you'd be surprised at what you'd noticed. Because probably you're so caught up in what's going on, oftentimes, that you don't notice what you're thinking, what's driving you, what you're trying to engage in, how you are, what you're feeling. But to really stop and notice what's really going on here clarifies life a lot, helps a lot, keeps you out of trouble. Some people like to do this, use a telephone as a mindfulness bell. The phone rings. Some people's attitude about the phone ringing is it's desperately important to get to the phone as quickly as possible. The fewer the rings, the more polite it is or something. I don't know what. But you can adjust the answering machine so you can get like 7 rings or 6 rings. And then don't answer the phone so quickly. Let it go 3 or 4 rings. And use that time to check in. Be with your breath, relax, be present. And then answer. Some people like to do certain activities during the day. And so, you know, like I said, just driving. But vary it from week to week, which activities they try to be really present and mindful for. Washing dishes, cooking, shopping, cleaning, walking from where you park your car to your place of work, doing walking meditation there. So choosing over a whole year, choosing many different other daily activities, you can infuse with mindfulness and presence. Find out what's really like to be here in your body, present for what's going on. It's really a delight. to be present. It's really a wonderful thing to begin feeling like you're inhabiting your life as it's being lived, rather than having the mind race ahead or concerned about what you're doing too much. And I don't know if I said this earlier in the course. I know people who meditate every day for half an hour or something, and then when they have feel like they don't have any time for meditation because they have a lot to do, then they'll meditate twice as much. And I've never done that as a policy, but sometimes when I felt harried and felt like, oh, I can't do it, I don't have time to take care of everything, I've stopped and sat for 10-15 minutes, and then miraculously I seem to have more time. I can't exactly describe to you what it is, but my mind will protest, I can't sit, I don't have time. Just sit, Gil. And I sit, and then, wow, I have all this time now. And I think part of this time thing, I mean, it's such a neurotic thing for modern people, isn't it? I suspect half of you have a neurotic relationship to time. Time is a concept. Time is a concept. If you can settle yourself enough in meditation not to be caught by concepts, you'll feel much more spacious around time. In fact, when you're really settled and quiet, you'll touch into a quality called timeless dimension, which is really a wonderful place to be, in the timeless present. In the timeless present, there's all the time you need. There's lots of time. Also, if the mind is more relaxed, more calm, often you tend to do things more efficiently, more carefully. And so, you know, you can often get a lot more done. So applying the practice in daily life. I've heard of people who get little sticky dots or something, and they'll stick it all over their place. And, you know, there's light switches and doorknobs or whatever. And whenever they see those little yellow stickers, you know, oh, what's happening? Let's be present. Little reminders to be present. So some people really, really enjoy starting to wake up, be present, be mindful in daily life, to bring some quality of attention to what's happening here and now. Some people actually find it more valuable than meditation to do it in daily life. Something to the different kind of effect or benefit that comes seemingly from doing it that way. One of the most interesting, or I would say one of the very useful places to extend the mindfulness practice beyond the cushion is in the moments, the minutes after you get up from your meditation session. Some people's attitude by getting up is just getting up and just getting busy with life, getting busy with life right away, and kind of forgot the fact that you're meditating. But to the degree to which you have some calm in your meditation, doesn't have to be very calm, but just a little bit more than usual, then you have a platform, a reference point for understanding how you lose that calm. You have a reference point to understand if you're a little bit relaxed. You have a reference point for understanding how you start getting contracted again. So what you do is, when you get up from your cushion or get up from your meditation session, stay mindful, start to be very present for yourself, and see if you can notice the first movement in your mind or in your body of feeling tense or feeling contracted or feeling anxious. Feeling caught. Oh, gotta do that. You get up from meditation, you're so relaxed and serene, and you walk by your desk, and there's a bill. You know? Whatever it might be. So stay mindful so you can catch that first moment. And then when you catch that first moment, stop. Maybe even close your eyes. And pay very careful attention to what just happened. In all the different ways you can pay attention physically, pay attention emotionally to what happened, pay attention cognitively to what happened, to see what you're believing. What are the beliefs that supported that contraction? And then question in some deep way, is it necessary to get contracted? Is it necessary to get tense? Is it necessary to get anxious around what I just got anxious about? You saw the bill? Is it necessary? And you might have an opportunity there, coming out of meditation, to catch something right at the beginning and then let go of it. Or to reevaluate what makes you operate. To have a new relationship to what makes you operate. Once you leave meditation and get back into your life full swing, you might be so going so fast and so caught up and so anxious that you see that bill and it makes you anxious, but compared to everything else you're thinking about, it's like you hardly know, you don't even notice it. It just goes unnoticed. There's an opportunity when you have the reference point of calm or relaxation in meditation, or clarity from meditation, to notice something. So that's one practice some people like to do, is at the end of the meditation session, to give themselves time so they can be very attentive to what happens and catch that first moment. Now, if you want to make a game out of it, the enlightenment game, then you can see if you can extend how long you stay open, relaxed, how long you do. So maybe the first time you do this exercise, it's, you know, maybe 10 seconds. But then as you do it, maybe you can begin stretching, until finally you get to 10 minutes, and 20 minutes, and an hour. And wouldn't that be interesting? So two different ways of developing the practice. Three different ways of doing the practice. You can just do the basic practice that I've taught you and get the benefits that come. You could think about how to enhance the practice by developing greater concentration, greater continuity, and you can begin practicing in daily life. And I would be very sad if someone left this course and only felt that mindfulness had to do with meditation. I think it has to do with our whole life. It's arbitrary, the line between meditation time and the rest of time.